Accession number 9424, Reel 12.
Mr. Cooper, Reel 12. You were describing the camp at Boulogne and your duties as a night watchman. Could you go into what you had to do as a night watchman?
Yes, well, it's St. Martin's camp on the hill above Boulogne, and it wasn't really a camp. I suppose it was a transit camp really, for troops, and for officers they had this quite large mess. And when I first went there, they asked me if I wanted to be a waiter. I said, no, I don't want to be a waiter. I felt that a bit intriguing, I think, after all I'd been through. And then so they put me in the pantry as a handyman and just had to wash up and so on, that sort of thing. Then very soon I was told they wanted me to be a night watchman. I was an individual on my own. I had to report for duty about 6 in the evening, and then I had a meal in the kitchen. And I had to see that there were no intruders in the mess, because I was really to keep watch. And then I had to clean up the dining room, clean up the ante room, and set the fire for the next morning with chips and coal, etc. And then about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, I used to have a meal, because the chef there, big tall chap, I think he took rather a liking to me, and he said, well, now, have a good meal when you have one. He said, here's the key of the pantry, help yourself to everything. And that's just what I did. Fried eggs and bacon and big load of porridge from the porringer. In fact, I still, about every week, I have what I call a St. Martin's camp porridge. I make myself porridge and put the brown sugar on, and an undiluted can of ideal milk. And I always call it the St. Martin's camp porridge.
At the camp, was that very far out of Boulogne?
Actually, I think it was a couple of miles out of the city, yes. Oh, quite countrified all around. And of course we had been brought down there to go on this Boulogne-Cologne Express. But they weren't quite right. I suppose the other members were being demobbed. That's why they wanted replacements. And there was a bit of a hold-up. I think we were in St. Martin's camp probably, might have been well over a month. And then went down to join the train.
Mm. Were you still attached to your regiment at that point?
No. I was attached to the NACB, Navy and Army Canteens Board. In fact, I didn't know, but after I'd been with them sometimes, they asked if anybody wanted to transfer to the NACB, a branch of the RASC, Royal Army Service Corps. And I signed the form and more or less forgot about it. And we got £3.10 a week, which was a terrific amount, and 25% bonus. That was to sort of keep us, because everybody wanted to be demobilised.
Did you actually worry about not being demobilised? Did you resent that?
Not a bit. Oh, no, I didn't mind. I had no job to go back to. No, I didn't mind. And I enjoyed myself on the train. It was marvellous.
Well, perhaps you could tell us what your duties were on the train.
Yes, well, when I first went on the train, I was a sort of handyman in the kitchen. And the train was an old, not old really, but it was an English English train, an English ambulance train, and from fore to aft it was all a matter of the long coaches full of three-tiered beds which the officers used, and mattresses and everything. And all we had to do, we only served them cold meals, and that was all the stuff was put on the train at Boulogne. And we'd leave Boulogne about two in the afternoon, and we'd get to Cologne around about 1 p.m. next day. and it took us all, I think, we served them with lunch, you see, directly we left, and then we served them in the evening, and then again breakfast in the morning.
Could you tell me something about the actual team, or crew who worked the train that you were part of? How was that organised?
There was an officer, rank of captain or lieutenant, who was the train conducting officer. Of course, we didn't mix with him much, being an officer. And there was a sergeant of the train, and then I think we probably had four or five waiters, and the handyman, a cook, an assistant cook. That was about the staff. And I had quite a nice little compartment, two bunks in, and the sergeant of the train had the top bunk, and I had the bottom one. Real old cockney. He used to go around his own mother and the vegetable stall they had in the East End. Then he was a very nice chap, Sergeant Ruff. And then, of course, apart from our duties of serving all the officers, when the train at each end, we had to clean it all and see that the beds were made up and the whole place clean, ready for the next departure. And in Boulogne, of course, we used to arrive in Boulogne. I can't just remember what time, but we had quite a lot of time off, and we used to go down to Boulogne, bathe in the sea and so on. Then, and of course, a little racket began on the train, because the German population, of course, was cigarettes. You could get anything for a couple of cigarettes and soap. They were so short of stuff. And there was a chap there, wasn't content with taking a box of cigarettes, that he started in a big way. And he started off with cartons of cigarettes, and it grew and grew until he was actually going to the NACB store places in Boulogne, got piled into them, and it's like he'd take a wooden case full of cartons of cigarettes. Now, how did he get it up? So he used to pay so much to this storekeeper on there. We had a storage van, all the blankets and things and food. And when the train was in the siding at Boulogne, an NACB van would drive up to the end of the train, and he'd help him on with the case of cigarettes, and then the door was closed. Then his customer in Germany was the station master at the siding, Cologne Deutsch. And he was a Jewish fellow, so there were no flies on him. He made an arrangement with the station master at Cologne Deutsch, and then it started, the business grew and grew. And he used to, the station master, about midnight, when our train was in the siding, would provide an engine and a van, would come up alongside our train and stop outside our store van. And this chap, Sharky, the case would be transferred into it, and Puff would go the engine and up to the station master's place then. How much he made out of that, I don't know. But there was a time he was going on leave. So he asked me if I'd take a few cartons of cigarettes up, me and another chap. So I didn't quite like that. I said, yes, all right. So I think I took two big boxes of Players up, or three perhaps.
Not big...
Old case, no, I wasn't having that. I just took these few up. And he said, well, you could go and see the... He said, when about midnight, he said, just get off, put them in a sack. He said, now, he said, because of stores being stolen on trains, they've got a sentry going up and down the train all the time. He said, give him 20 marks and just say you're taking some cigarettes to the station master. So I said, all right, and then stayed up with this other chap on the train. When he got to about midnight, I was feeling very guilty there, because I didn't like doing it a bit. We stepped out of the train, jumped down onto the track, and I put the sack over my shoulder, and we hadn't walked long. There was a vision in the distance. He said, halt, who goes there? And this sentry with the banner, I said, we're just taking a few cigarettes to the station master. He said, well, what's in that sack? I said, the cigarettes. And just then, another player came and said, hello, what's here? It was a sergeant of the guard. He said, what's that? He said, well, sergeant, he said, they've offered me 20 marks, he said, to let them pass with these cigarettes. John said, oh, they have had that. And the centre point said, he said, yes, here's the 20 marks that they have offered me. Sergeant snatched the 20 marks. He said, go on, you two buggers. And then next morning I went to the station master's office. You see, I think, I don't know how many marks I had, but it worked out at about £3 for me and the other chap. £3 each, but it was quite poor. And I never did that again. I hated the whole business.
What rank was Sharkey? Was he an ordinary private?
Oh, he was private, yes. Yes, he worked on the train.
To what extent were people aware of this going on? I mean, obviously the sentries were aware of it, and so was the... Was the officer in charge aware of it?
He was aware of it, no. It was all done late at night. And then this chap, Sharkey, he began doing it the other way. You could buy toys in Cologne for... Well, I remember getting a lovely shaving mirror with reflection, concave and convex each time. And that was just one thing I bought. The cost me the equivalent of sixpence. And anyway, he started taking toys down to Boulogne, selling them to the toy shops. He must have made a fortune. German razors, sets of table cutlery. Also, and he wasn't content. Well, then he got demobbed, so he had to give it up. But within a few weeks, he was paying his own way out to Germany and carried on the business then. And he'd have four or five cases of stuff, and the soldiers weren't allowed to take more than one case home. You see, he said he was going on leave, it was just presents. And so he used to chat up the people going on the ship. He said, look here, I've got one case, he said, extra that I've forgotten about. He said, will you take it on board and take it through the customs for me? Chaps would say yes, and he'd go to someone else and he got the whole six cases. How long he kept on, I don't know. I bet he's a millionaire now. So that was that on the train.
Perhaps we could remain in Cologne for a moment and look at the conditions of the people in Cologne. Did you see much evidence of the effect of the war on the German civilians?
Oh, yes, you could see it, especially in the shops. And also that they would give anything for a few cigarettes and soap. And you'd see a confectioner's shop, which you'd expect to see cakes in. You'd see a fancy cake. And to find out it was just froth. There were no proper cakes for sale at all. But the people looked all right. And then when the train was in at the siding in Cologne, we used to have four or five Germans come on in their dungarees doing cleaning in the train. And we used to talk to them quite a lot, and we used to give them cigarettes, but they keep saying, Germany fertig, Germany finished, no good. But it was only in the shops. You see, we didn't go to any of the German homes, but they were extremely short of foods and luxuries. And the mark was climbing to hundreds of the pound. Well, I wasn't there long enough when it got to sort of thousands of the pound. But I used to buy things to take home very, very, very cheaply. 4711 Eau de Cologne, about a shilling a bottle in the equivalent, because their big shop was there. But we had no evidence of enmity of the people. We'd go to the theatres and shops, and they just as if you were going to a shop in England.
Mm-hmm. What entertainments were available for you in Cologne?
Well, we had the British Empire Leave Club, which was it had been a huge theatre. And they had dancing there, and then they'd have shows. I think they had Housey, and one or two of the theatres where they just had plays and musicals, all by English actors and actresses. There was always something to do there. And then we used to sometimes take a trip up the Rhine on one of the Rhine boats, cheap again. And we were allowed. Oh yes, we didn't pay. We didn't pay at all to go on trams or trains. That was all free.
At times like that, did you meet any sort of reaction from German civilians who saw you travelling around?
No, none at all. And of course I couldn't speak to them because of the language, and I didn't speak any German.
Did you see any evidence of the sort of political turmoil that was going on in Germany at that time?
No. No.
Could you tell me something about the recreations that you enjoyed in Boulogne and the atmosphere in Boulogne after the war?
Well, there was nothing laid on for troops in Boulogne, at least I never found out there was, because we only came there, you see, we just used to have the afternoon off and the evening, and we used to go down to the sea and bathe in the sea and go and perhaps have a meal out. But we didn't converse with the French people at all, mainly, of course, also language. But we were accepted. Nobody took any notice of us because there were, of course, lots of troops. They're mainly passing through for demobilisation.
How long did you work on the train for?
Well, it was nearly a year. Because I left the train in March 1920, and I joined it in March or April 1919.
And why did you leave working on the train?
Well, because my demobilisation came up, and I'd signed on for a year, because the carrot was, if you signed on for a year, you got £3.10 a week and 25% bonus at the end of it. And of course, on the train, there was one job I did there which I haven't mentioned. The corporal came to me one day and said, "Oh, you told me you didn't want to be a waiter. Well, I'm going to put you on the general's coach on the next time we go up to Cologne." I said, "Well, I don't think I..." He said, "That's an order." He said, "It's not..." So he said, "You better put your best uniform on, and when we leave for Boulogne next time," he said, "actually, that it was a first class English coach. It was part of the ambulance, right? And they weren't all the generals travelling. It was called the general's coach, but for anyone of field rank, that is major and above." Well, I quite liked that. I just used to take in their meals, and they were very chatty, and said, what are you doing here?" I said, "Well," I said, "it's much better than being in the company." And of course, they used to bring out a 10-franc note when they got off, so I used to send some home. I got quite a few. And then occasionally, say for instance, I remember we stopped at Herberstall on the German border once, and an officer came on and we hadn't got any accommodation. He said, "Well, can I get on?" I said, "Oh, no, not." And he said, "Oh, come on." So I let him onto the train. I think he gave me 100 francs.
Because that was presumably against regulations.
Yeah.
Did you meet any famous generals whilst you were travelling?
Not any famous ones, no. But they were, it was surprising, as I was a private, they were all very friendly and chatty when I...
What sort of things did they talk to you about?
Well, it was more or less confined to remarks. We didn't have long conversations, but remarks of where I'd been and where I'd been in France and what regiment I was in and so on and so forth. Just general war talk, but it wasn't a sort of... matey powwow in those days. The general, even a sergeant major, you never spoke to familiarly.
Okay, perhaps we can then return to demobilisation. Could you describe how that came about?
Well, I was notified that I'd be demobilised on a certain date, and that I got a pass over to go to. To go to London. I was given a pass up to Lancaster, the depot of the King's Own Royal Lancaster Regiment. So I arrived up in Lancaster and was in the barracks. I didn't hear anything for a few days. I was on one or two of their parades, etc. And then the first one parade wasn't on. I was asked by the sergeant, "Why was that?" I said, "Well, I've only come up here for demobilisation." I said, "I didn't think I had to go." He said, "Well," he said, "you had to go." He said, "And you're up for orders and to get CB, of course, some confined to..." The first time I'd been up for any sin since I joined the army.
Could you explain what CB meant?
Well, you weren't allowed to go outside the perimeter of the barracks.
What does CB stand for?
Confined to barracks, and you had to go on a morning parade, just answer your name. I don't think I had to go on any other parades, and then it was very shortly after that that I was told I was being sent to Lancaster for demobilisation. So Cross went up to Lancaster, reported there, and then they sent me to the Lancaster records office, and apparently I was lost, they couldn't find me. And so they said, oh, you're not with the King's Own Regiment. They said, you've been transferred to the Royal Army Service Corps. I said, well, I signed the form months ago. I said, but I didn't think anything had ever happened. He said, oh, yes, you've transferred to the Royal Army Service Corps, NACB. He said, so we're going to send you down to Woolwich. So I got a pass down to Woolwich. I reported at the Woolwich Records office, and they had, oh, yes, I was in their barracks of the Royal Army Service Corps, you see. Well, while I was on the train on Boulogne, being more or less freelance, I took liberties with my uniform, and I bought a lovely pair of riding breeches from one chap once on the train, and had these, of course, riding breeches were for either grooms or officers. And I had my riding breeches on when I got to the RSC barracks. And, of course, they thought I was a horseman. So slept in the barracks, and I had to get on parade next morning, RASC, and they took me down among all these horses, staring at me and showing that I'd never been on a horse in my life. So the sergeant said, come on there, what are you doing, Dozy? Come on, stand to your feeds. And I looked at the others, that meant they had to get the big nose bag ready and stand in front of the horse. This horse looked at me and bared its teeth and flattened its ears. And then he said, all right, feed. And I lift up this bag and I couldn't get it out of the horse's nose. And at last I got it over its head, yeah. So that was an experience. And anyway...
Did you break it to the sergeant that in fact you had nothing to do with horses?
No, he just left me alone after that. He probably thought I was a bit dozy. And then I went down to the records office... And they said, as I told you before, that I'd been transferred to the RSC, said, well, the RSC NACB, the depot's in London at Pimlico. So another pass and went down to London. And there was a big house in Pimlico, and that was apparently the office for demobilisation for the NACB, the Army and Navy Canteens Board. And they had a record of me, and I was in there about 10 minutes, and they were signed out to mobilise and given the pass to go home to Southport on leave. And that's the last I saw of the army.
I see. Did you think of taking on any continued service in the army?
No. I only thought of that extra time because I thought, well, there won't be jobs in England, and it's very good, this pay of £3.10 a week, very tempting for me, not having a job at home. So I signed on for that year, you see. But I had no idea of continuing with the army. It was just a sort of stopgap for me.
But you didn't have a job to go to as yet?
No.
Were you given any payoffs for your army service?
Well, that I can't remember. Yes, wait a minute now. I hadn't drawn a lot of my pay while I was on the train, and so I had to write, and they sent me about £100, and I thought to myself, well, it must be more than that. So I wrote to them again, and I think three times altogether they sent me, I think altogether I got about £200 or £300, and I'm not even sure to this day whether that was right.
Did you have to return your... Well, presumably you did have to return your equipment. Do you remember what process you went through?
I can't remember. I can't remember what I did with my uniform. It must have gone somewhere. I'm sure they didn't take it from me at Pimlico. No, I can't remember. That's the thing I can't remember.
So, did you travel back to Southport after Pimlico?
Yes. On leave. I think I got about a month's leave, I think it was, with pay.
This would be the first home leave you'd had since you first went to the Western Front?
Yes, yes.
So presumably you told a lot of people about your experiences in the war.
I didn't.
You did not?
I don't think they were interested.
Did people understand, the civilians understand what the Western Front had been like?
Well, of course they did. They knew it was pretty awful, I think, in that every village and town were all in dread of a knock at the door and a telegram coming saying, we've got to report that your son was killed in action, so on and so on. They knew it. Of course, there were no films shown of the fighting at all till afterward, because they didn't want to depress people. I suppose a lot of them didn't want them to quite know what it was like, but they knew because of all the deaths that it was pretty bad. And of course, some chaps came back from the Western Front and probably told everyone all about it. No, I didn't. People didn't even ask me.
Were you surprised at that at the time?
No, I don't think I was. Well, it was just of course, that's when I began writing my own report, and I had a very good memory. Everything was catalogued in my brain. So the first time up, the second time up, Packet Wood, Canal, I could remember almost. I could remember every day.
What made you start to write that?
Well, I thought I'd like to write for my own record and for my mother to read it. I called it The Story when I sent it to her, or wrote it to her. And then, as you know, wrote it from sheets of foolscap, etc., rewrote it on quarto plain paper, and then it remained like that for about 40 years, unlooked at by anybody. And it was only when these friends, which I still have, showed their interest in the war, and I let them read it, and they were very interested. And that's what started them wanting to go out to France after the war, and they said they'd like to go, so I went to them and showed them all the places that they'd read about.
Looking
and then they persuaded me to show it to the Imperial War Museum, and you know what happened after that.
Mm. Looking back, do you think that the war affected you in any particular way?
Not psychologically, no. Excepting for quite a long time I used to dream it had started again. I had quite a dread then that it had started again, that there were the King's Own were going up for an attack, or there was a big attack by the Germans. Then I used to wake up and thank goodness that it was a dream. Just that much. But I don't think, as a man, anyone would notice any difference in me at all.
What about your attitudes to life in general? Do you think they've been changed by the war?
No. No, I don't think so. I think on the whole, I took it pretty calmly.
What job did you get when you started employment in civilian life?
Well, I had no particular qualifications. I didn't quite know what I wanted to do. But I had an uncle in the Canard Seamstry Company. He was an officer on one of the ships. He said, well, how would you like to be a junior assistant purser on the ship? So I admitted I didn't know what it was, but he explained to me that it was in the office on the ship. And I'd have a sort of junior officer's rank. He said, anyway, you can try it, and if you don't like it, you can always leave. Then I went for an interview, and then I later got a letter from the Cunard asking me to report at the head office, and that I would sail in the Coronia as junior assistant purser on 6th of July 1920. And I continued with that, and